I'm Rachel Brown, and in all my time reporting on crime and courts for the ABC, I've seen a lot of monsters. But this crime chilled me more than the others. The man behind it, a pilot you wouldn't think twice about if you met him on the street. Someone who flies under the radar. Someone with secrets simmering just below the surface. Huntsman, the latest season of the ABC's true crime podcast, Unravel. Hear Unravel now on the ABC Listen app.
For Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, amid revelations the Bondi gunman travelled to a terrorist hotspot in the Philippines prior to the deadly attack, questions are being asked over whether that could or should have been picked up by Australia's intelligence agencies. You'll hear from former Director General of ASIO, Dennis Richardson.
There may well have been a failure, or there may well have been a combination of failures. Equally, it is possible that ASIO made the right judgments at the right time.
Then we speak to Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers about the mid-year budget update and the state of the economy.
There's always more work to do, and we've now handed down seven budgets or budget updates, and in every single one of those there have been savings.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. The surviving alleged gunman in the Bondi terror attack remains under police guard in hospital today after being charged with 59 offences, including 15 counts of murder, one for each of the victims. In wake of the attack, questions are being asked of the nation's intelligence agencies, from resourcing levels to information gathering. For more on this, host Melissa Clark spoke with Dennis Richardson. He's considered one of Australia's most distinguished bureaucrats, former Secretary of the Departments of Defence and Foreign Affairs, and for 9 years, he was the Director General of ASIO.
Based on what we know so far and of the information that's in the public domain, can we tell if there has been a failure of intelligence agencies to pick up on these gunmen and prevent this attack?
Not yet. A few days after any terrorist attack, you always have far more questions than answers. I think it's very important not to rush to judgment. There may well have been a failure, or there may well have been a combination of failures. Equally, it is possible that ASIO made the right judgments at the right time. We simply don't know. You simply need to put a question mark over that, which is why there will need to be a major inquiry at some point.
There have been calls for a royal commission, perhaps most vocally by the former Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. Do you think a royal commission or a commission of inquiry type of process is something that is necessary or helpful?
I'm agnostic in respect of a royal commission. They do take a long time, as the government has said. There is a tendency for governments to hide behind a royal commission and say there is action we can't take until we get the results of it. An inquiry of a different sort can move far more quickly and can give you quicker answers. I think there's a balance there that needs to be struck. Equally, with a Royal Commission, you can require people to give evidence under oath, but I think there would be ways around that.
If I can just go to actions and reach of intelligence agencies here, obviously by the nature of the work that ASIO does, exactly how it operates and its extent isn't something that's really public knowledge. But there's definitely a lot of questions being asked publicly about, well, if someone who has previously been looked at for potentially connections to extremists, if that person then visits a terrorism hotspot around the world, isn't that the sort of thing a security agency would know about? Can you give us an understanding of the scope or the reach of what our intelligence agencies and our partner intelligence agencies overseas can and can't feasibly know in a structural sense?
Well, first of all, you've got to operate within the law. Secondly, you must operate within your own resource constraints. Therefore, you must make priorities and shift the resources where you believe the biggest threats are. Thirdly, you are always dealing with incomplete information. You are rarely dealing with an environment in which you know everything. So it's a bit of a human puzzle that you're dealing with. You need to ask yourself this: if ASIO in 2019 looked at one of the gunmen, and if they made a considered, proper assessment, and if they rightly came to a conclusion that he did not pose a threat to security, then you would need to ask yourself, why would he be on a movement alert list 5 years later? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether what sort of assessment they did in 2019. I don't know what conclusions they reached. And you would need to know that before you could make a decision about whether they should have put him on the movement alert list.
Former Director General of ASIO, Dennis Richardson there. Taking a closer look at federal politics now, the government has this week delivered the first comprehensive update to the nation's finances since the federal election earlier this year. The Mid-Year Economic and Fiscal Outlook, or MYEFO, indicates the budget's bottom line has been improved slightly by more than $8 billion over the next 4 years when compared to earlier forecasts. All of this, of course, comes as the government faces questions over what action it will take following the Bondi attack. And that's exactly where Mel started this interview with Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
You acknowledged yesterday that has been the focus of the government and of the country right now. And you and other cabinet ministers have said more needs to be done. When it comes to what you as Treasurer can do, is there any need to reassess resourcing for the Federal Police and ASIO in light of this attack?
Well, first of all, as you suggest in your question, Mel, I mean, we understand that this week's not about the mid-year budget update. You know, that the country and the government is singularly focused on the aftermath of this horrifying act of evil anti-Semitism. And so that's where our focus has been throughout the week. In terms of our support for our agencies, we have been increasing funding for our anti-terrorism efforts over the life of this government. From memory, an extra $500 million or so for counter-terrorism, another couple of $100 million for countering violent extremism and dealing with foreign interference. And so we have made it clear that even with these extra resources that we have contributed to the effort, we are obviously acting with some urgency now and considering what other steps might be necessary. And as Treasurer, you know, I'm obviously part of those discussions.
When it comes to the broader government response to this, we've heard suggestions from former Treasurer Josh Frydenberg that a Royal Commission is warranted to assess what has happened and what should be done now. Do you think a Royal Commission would be helpful?
I mean, we want our agencies 100% focused on the investigations, and we don't want them delayed or deterred by a Royal Commission. You know, everyone's focus, including the agencies involved here, needs to be on the investigation, needs to be on getting to the bottom of what happened here, primarily because that will help inform us as we take additional necessary steps.
Would a Royal Commission delay or deter action in the meantime? We've seen other Royal Commissions in recent years, perhaps the aged care, one into aged care is an example of where reform efforts were begun whilst a commission was underway. Are they necessarily mutually exclusive?
Well, the point I'm trying to convey to your listeners, and I think the point that Tony was making last night, is we want our agencies 100% focused on the investigation. That's the best use of their time, and that's our focus as well.
Let's turn to the budget. This update shows that the budget deficits will be better off by $8 billion over the next 4 years. But the outlook's much the same. Deficits sitting at around $36, $37 billion at the end of the 4 years, and we're still in deficit in 10 years' time. There's a challenge is still there for you to turn around the budget, isn't it?
Well, there are still pressures on the budget. We've been upfront about that. Some of those pressures are intensifying rather than easing. But we've come a long way in the budget. We've made a heap of progress. You know, two budget surpluses, a much smaller deficit last year. And what we saw in the mid-year budget update yesterday is actually an improvement in the budget every year of the forward estimates, a stronger bottom line every year, less debt every year, and the government making a positive contribution to that with its savings and making sure that our policies are improving the budget rather than detracting from the budget. And that combination of factors is actually the first time that that's happened in a mid-year budget update in about the 30 years that governments have been handing them down. So by that combination of measures, better bottom line every year, less debt every year, government making net positive policy decisions. By those three issues being simultaneously present in yesterday's mid-year budget update, it actually makes it the most responsible mid-year update in the 30 years that governments have been handing them down.
I guess the question is it enough to deal with the challenge of the structural deficit that we face, given, yes, you've got net positive policy decisions here, but the increases we're seeing in revenue may not stick around in the years to come, given that they are in some part due to inflation, boosting incomes and company tax, the booming share market, things we can't rely on being there. But a lot of the pressures that you're talking about are permanent ones that have been built into the structural budget. So are the efforts that you've made so far, are they going to be enough to deal with the longer term structural deficit?
Oh, there's always more work to do. And we've now handed down seven budgets or budget updates. And in every single one of those, there have been savings. In every single one of those, we have taken responsible decisions to deal with these pressures on the budget. We don't pretend that that work is ever finished. Obviously, it's not. It's an ongoing task for all of us to make the budget more sustainable. But because of our efforts, you know, over the 3.5 years we've been in office, $114 billion worth of savings. The budget is more than $200 billion stronger than what we inherited. Debt is around $175 billion lower this year than it was forecast to be when we came to office. And so we have made a lot of progress in the budget. I think a lot of the commentary either accidentally or deliberately ignores that progress that has been made. The budget is much stronger than since we came to office, but we don't pretend for a moment that there's not more work to do.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers there. And for the opposition's view on the mid-year budget update, Mel spoke with Shadow Minister for Finance, James Paterson. During this interview, Mel also asked the Senator whether he agrees with former Treasurer Josh Frydenberg's call for a royal commission into the Bondi attack.
Jim Chalmers has said that the story of this mid-year budget update is one of delivery and responsibility, that they've been able to deliver improvements to the budget bottom line over the years ahead. Is that the sort of responsible economic management that the Coalition's been calling for?
No, it's not. The key test for Jim Chalmers and Katie Gallagher in my EFO was, did they do everything they could to take the pressure off rising inflation? And they've failed. And you don't need to take my word for it. One of Australia's most respected independent economists, Saul Eslake, is quoted in the Financial Review this morning saying they've done nothing to make Michelle Bullock's job any easier. The truth is inflation is above the band and rising, and there's a very real risk, if you listen to the Commonwealth Bank or the National Australia Bank, that interest rates will rise next year. And if that happens, that will be a body blow for Australian families. The reckless spending we've seen under Labor since they came to office has only continued and is making that problem worse.
One of the key things the Coalition has been calling for is reducing the size of public spending, and as part of that, the size of the public service. The government's found $6.8 billion in savings from the public service in this budget. Isn't that the kind of approach that you have been calling for?
Well, they have claimed to have found those savings. Let's see whether they actually deliver them in practice, because this is a government which often says they'll find savings in contractors and outsourcing and expenses, but then often fails to actually deliver it in practice, and often spending on those things are higher than they promised they would be. So let's see what they actually deliver, but let's look at the numbers that are actually in the budget. Government spending will rise in real terms by 4.5% this year. That's about twice the rate of economic growth. Government spending will remain the highest proportion of the economy for about 40 years outside the pandemic. The deficit is going to be 3 times larger this year than it was last financial year. And since they came to government, they've added $110 billion of net spending decisions. Now, all of those things put upward pressure on inflation and increase the risk of interest rate rises.
When it comes to those spending pressures, much of what has increased since the last budget update we had is things like extra spending on the aged pension, on veterans' entitlements, areas like natural disaster relief. Are those areas that you think should be cut back in the effort to try and get to a more sustainable payment level?
No, some of those things are things which should happen and no one would propose not happening. But actually, the decisions made by the Albanese government, the active policy choices they've made, are what have worsened the budget bottom line by $110 billion since they came to office. And what previous governments did is they had fiscal rules in place which said, of course, you can provide for new spending, but you have to offset that new spending. And actually, had the Albanese government had this discipline, they could have had a budget surplus last year and they could have had a budget surplus this year. This year, $38 billion of net decisions made by this government take effect, and that turns what is what could have turned a $37 billion deficit into a $1 billion surplus.
If I can turn to the Bondi terror attack and the response to those events on Sunday, you're part of the opposition's new Anti-Semitism, Extremism and Counter-Terrorism Task Force, which has met for the first time this week. Can you explain what this task force in opposition will do?
The task force is about taking action. It's about addressing the inaction and delays under the Albanese government over the last 2.5 years on anti-Semitism. As an opposition, we can't do everything, but one thing we can do is help the government take the steps it needs to take. And the most glaring and obvious one is their failure to respond to the Anti-Semitism Commissioner's report. Gillian Siegel was appointed by the Albanese government, handed down recommendations to them 5 months ago, and they're still yet to formally respond. And many of those things are things which could make our country safer and particularly make the Jewish community feel safer.
Gillian Siegel has said that the government has been working with her in this time, but now she would like to see that accelerated. So it's not that they haven't responded at all, they just haven't given a formal response and haven't moved on some of the recommendations. That's a fair assessment.
Gillian Siegel's being appropriately diplomatic, as she should as a government appointee, but I can be more critical. And when you look at the list of recommendations that she has made, almost none of them have been actioned by the federal government. No legislation has been introduced by the government in response to recommendations that Gillian Siegel made, and they are now saying they will accelerate the implementation. I really hope they do, and we will hold them to account if they don't, because the Australian Jewish community has been warning for 2 years that an event like this would happen.
If you have a sense of what should be done now and you see the Special Envoy's report as a blueprint for that, does a Royal Commission risk duplicating a plan that has already been developed by the specialist in this space?
No, not at all. We need to have a Royal Commission because only a Royal Commission can identify whether or not operational failures occurred here. A Royal Commissioner has the powers to get behind and look at the intelligence and policing issues. There may well have been no operational failures, but we won't know until we get to the bottom of that. And there may well have been policy failures as well. And Royal Commissions are very powerful at elucidating those issues. This is the worst ever terrorist attack in Australian history. We have had Royal Commissions about much more trivial matters than this, and I think it is the bare minimum we should expect from the government.
Shadow Minister for Finance, James Paterson. A change of pace now. Some of the country's most important First Nations artists have been brought together for the 5th National Indigenous Art Triennial at the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra. Titled After the Rain, the exhibition is designed to celebrate intergenerational legacies and cultural warriors of the past, present and future. Tony Albert is the artistic director of the show and is a celebrated artist in his own right. Mel spoke with him.
So tell me, why did you decide to name this exhibition After the Rain?
For me, this is the fifth iteration of the triennial, and I had been at the previous four, the very first one in 2007 as a really young, inspiring artist. I've been involved in the triennial as an artist myself since then, and this was a really an opportunity. It's the first artist-led one, so an opportunity to really do something different. And After the Rain represented that opportunity for me of looking back on where we've come from, where the state of contemporary Indigenous art currently sits, and what that future might look like for us, especially in this time of this very big global push and recognition of First Nations art on a much larger platform.
It's such a task to try to encompass those ideals when you're looking at trying to pull this together. So what's guiding your decision-making when you're figuring out what to select and what to develop when it comes to specific works and specific artists?
Yeah, it was really hard, obviously, being artist-led as well. It's a very different perspective of looking. A lot of these people are my friends or, you know, people I can call on just from my phone. But knowing and understanding from an artist's perspective what these biennales and triennales mean and represent. And for me, it really is the opportunity to create your most seminal work of your career. Institutions have such a powerful force of resources behind them. And I wanted to kind of penetrate within that and utilize this opportunity as artistic director to work with artists to really create these very immersive spaces, something quite spectacle-driven but still grounded in the conceptual nature of what those works are. So I didn't see something by the artist and say, oh, let's put that in the show. We spoke very early about this opportunity of engagement and where we can push the work to. So it's a unique and very different perspective in a way. And I think the installations will surprise a lot of people.
Can you give me a sense of what the installations and this immersive experience is like? We're just an audio medium, so we're very limited in what sense. So can you give us a bit of an audio picture of what an audience can expect when they come to the National Gallery?
Sure. Each artist almost has their own room, and within those rooms, dedicated ideas to the thematic of what that was. So say House of Namajira as kind of the central room of the exhibition. I wanted to work with Albert Namajira, this seminal artist who, you know, is a metaphorical of so many of what has followed within his footsteps, under a collection that has 97 Albert Namajiras to pull from, which was incredible. And I thought, oh my God, yes, this is amazing. But from that, I realized I have to work with the Hermannsburg potters, Ilton Ajara, the school, the many hands school of art that follows in that Hermannsburg style of painting, and of course, his great grandson, Vincent Namajira. And through that, going to Hermannsburg, finding Albert Namajira's house, which sits on the edge of the Larapinta River that he built himself after applying for land grants in other areas of Australia, but was denied that opportunity to do so. And we're able to build and recreate Albert's house within the exhibition, but out of stained glass window through the glassworks in Canberra's assistance and recycled glass from Alice Springs from the 1970s. So just this opportunity to really delve into a lot of history and work together with artists on telling these really, really important stories are new for the first time.
Tony, you've spoken about wanting to set new standards for how institutions work with First Nations artists. Tell me what sort of long-term changes you hope might come about after this triennial. What's the sort of difference you want to see ingrained in the practices of our big institutions?
Yeah, again, as an artist-led triennial, I really wanted the artist's voice to be across all aspects of the show. So for Aretha Brown, not only creating this incredible, almost 40-meter-long historical mural to start the show, Aretha has done the branding for the show, the digital assets online. Vincent Namajira painted every other artist in the exhibition. So instead of an institutional photograph of an artist to promote the exhibition, we've got a painting by one of Australia's greatest portraiture artists, of all the other artists in the show. Just at every opportunity, from the publication to the public programming, having artists coming and sitting inside the institution with staff. It's normally the curator's job to be a conduit between the institution and I guess these artists, but this was a chance to really bring the artists in, having them sit at tables with staff working together and breaking down what I believe are still barriers that exist between the institution and the communities that they represent.
Tony Albert, Artistic Director of the 5th National Indigenous Art Triennial, which is now showing at the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra up until April 26 next year. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Melissa Clark, produced by the Radio National Breakfast Team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you the same time tomorrow.